Hello, beloved listeners, and welcome to another edition of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, delighted to be your host again and share more goodness. Each week we look for guests that are going to help us to learn important things that we can apply to improving the quality of our lives. And there's so much going on. And today we are blessed. We have a wonderful guest who has spent many, many years researching and dealing with what does it take to get better sleep. Her book is called Insomniac, and Dr. Gail Green, who is a professor of literature and women's studies at Scripps College in Claremont, California, and her graduate school background at Columbia was in Shakespeare, which is a subject that she still teaches. And she's, what a diverse background. She's published books on feminist theory and contemporary women's writers, and including a study of Nobel Prize winner Doris Lessing. Now, in the 90s, her interest shifted to science. And in 1999, she wrote The Woman Who Knew Too Much, which is about Alice Stewart and the secrets of radiation. It's a biography of the pioneer radiation epidemiologist whose research turned up the links between fetal x-ray and childhood cancer. So this is powerful. And then, you know, Gail or Dr. Green or Professor Green, you can, just depends on what you want to call her, then began researching insomnia and reading everything she could lay her hands on. And for the past several years has been attending American and European meetings of sleep societies and interviewing sleep researchers worldwide. That's why it took basically 6 years to put this book together. She's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, a professional medical society for researchers and clinicians, and a board member and the patient representative of the American Insomnia Association, which is an organization within the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. So get ready to learn more about an important subject so that we can be more informed. Welcome aboard, Gail.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that
introduction. Oh, it's a pleasure. It's just exciting. I can see that you have a passion for not only the arts with Shakespeare, but have gone into important subjects about the work of Alice Stewart and what happened to her when her research came out, and then now on insomnia, I'm hearing, and you could probably fill this in more, about 50 million Americans are dealing with sleep deprivation, and right. And so there's a lot of books about insomnia. I'm wondering, your book called Insomnia, how is it different from the others?
Yeah, Yeah, you said it's a huge problem. It affects millions of people. And I kept looking, as an insomniac, I've had this problem all my life. I kept looking for the book that would help me, you know, and I never found it. I found a lot of the same old advice I've been hearing for, you know, 5 decades, really, because my father was a doctor, and he would tell me the same things doctors tell me today. When I was, you know, an adolescent, he'd say, go to bed at the same time, you know, don't get so wound up, have a hot bath, just relax, just lie there, you'll get sleepy. And I didn't find anything that was helpful, and so I really wanted to find out what the research was up to, so I started going to these conferences and to talk to the insomniacs. Nobody ever bothered to talk to us, like, what do we know, what can we bring to the table? We live in our bodies, after all.
Yeah,
and I set out and I interviewed dozens and dozens of people with the problem, and I found out some amazing things, really.
Wow! And I like the way you begin with a bit of dry humor for people that are having sleep problems. In chapter one of your book, there's a quote from W.C. Fields, which I would guess put a smile on your face.
The cure for insomnia, get plenty of sleep.
Yeah.
It's treated about that seriously, I find. You know, I actually had a doctor tell me, oh, there's nothing wrong with you except you can't sleep. Doctors don't take it seriously. I think part of the problem is doctors' own background and training is such a hazing and sleep deprivation. They kind of pride themselves sometimes on how little sleep they get. You know, that's my one feeling I have about that.
Wow! Yeah.
Yeah.
That would make a lot of sense. That if you go to people who had to spend however many years it took them to get through medical school, and they were pushed and stressed and didn't get as much sleep and got trained to use drugs to get by to get through medical school, why would they have much sympathy for someone that can't get a good night's rest?
And there's, you know, there's a kind of, I got through it, oh, you should be able to get through it. But it's not just doctors, it's everywhere in the society. It's in the business world, it's really cool if you're, you know, can make it on 3, 4, 5 hours of sleep. It shows you're really, you know, at the top of the heap. And, you know, I get it from my students all the time, you know, things like I'll sleep when I'm dead, or sleep is so weak. So if you admit you have a sleep problem, you know, people look at you like you're just not really cutting it, you know, you're a wuss or something, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, and I kept getting told, well, maybe you just don't need that much sleep. Well, I really do know how much sleep I need, and I need 7 hours just like most people. There's a huge range of variability. Some people need as little as 5, some as much as 10, you know, to feel good and to function well. It's all over the place how much sleep people need, but you really do have to kind of, I think, trust the user, you know, trust the inside information. I need 7. My body wants to give me 2, 3, or 4, you know, but I'm not Margaret Thatcher and Napoleon Bonaparte, these people who, you know, were able to rule empires and so forth, you know, on, you know, huge dynamos of energy. I'm just kind of normal.
Yeah.
In my needs, not in my capacity.
Okay, and you've determined that 7 is good for you just after kind of getting to know yourself and seeing what feels right, or?
Yeah, exactly. That's how you do it. You just get to know yourself and see what feels right. I love 7. I so rarely get it without some kind of medication. I do use medication to sort of fill in sleep. I don't tough it out on 2, 3, 4 hours anymore the way I used to.
Because you were just finding that you weren't able to function at full capacity, or?
Yeah, oh, I wasn't. And I was cranky and depressed and no good to anybody, really, you know. And I just, it wasn't, the quality of my life was so diminished when I was doing that for long periods of time. And, people have a terrible time functioning without sleep.
Yeah, well, here's something. As you were speaking that, the thought came dancing across my mind about the term road rage, because you had made a mention of, you know, some irritability, and kind of, you know, in a free association moment there, it was like, okay, well, where does this apply? And then that was one area, and then I thought, wow, well, if there's a large number of people in our society that aren't getting the quality of rest they need to have themselves functioning, would it be really a surprise that there would be what we could mildly say is irritability? Road rage is taking it to another level.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a definite connection there, and there's also, I mean, there's other things, you know, like going postal and what, phone rage, office rage. I mean, there's all these other, you know, terms that have been coined around that that really suggest how many people are sitting on kind of tinderbox about to explode. And then you also read, of course, that people are stinting on sleep. They're cutting, you know, their hours shorter. And sleep is, you know, it's just not taken seriously in this society. It is so serious. It's the fuel of life. It makes for quality consciousness and creativity and attention and memory, and yet it's like treated like it's, I don't know, it's nothing. It's not important.
Yeah, now, yeah, this I American, just, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, this American Academy of Sleep Medicine, do you finding that is, you know, a place that's helpful in bringing more awareness, or how's that doing?
Yeah, definitely, and also the National Sleep Foundation has set out to, I mean, their motto is Wake America Up to the Importance of Sleep, and they're doing, you know, they are getting some press, they're getting media coverage and stuff like that, and I'm so glad for these organizations, because I feel like we're on the same, you know, we have the same goal, that, you know, to convince people who seem somehow to have lost sight of it, that this is, sleep is so important. But I also feel that these kind of, you know, these people are also not enlisting the insomniacs, you know, the people who have sleep disorders. They might, like, ask us more what we know, invite us more into the organization, which the AASM did with me. They actually put me on the board of the American Insomnia Association, which is, you know, terrific, but I also think that insomniacs need to organize on our own behalf, make our voices heard.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's important, because I don't know if that factors in when people are going to doctors and they have a condition. I mean, if they give some diagnosis, you've got this disease, that disease, or maybe have you know, medical coverage, you know, work things. I'm not sure how this is playing out in the workforce, in terms of people getting some help.
Oh yeah, there's that too. I mean, it's let me just go back to going to the doctor. When you go to the doctor and get a physical done, and you fill out that form, you know, major surgeries, major illnesses, they ask you all those questions. They don't ask anything about sleep. You know, again, it's kind of the invisible thing. And also, doctors get very little training in sleep. They get 1 to 2 hours in most medical schools in America and in U.S. and in the U.K. and in Europe. It's the same situation. Doctors just get very little training. But, you know, the other part of your question was, I mean, in the workplace, I think employers are kind of insensitive. I mean, they need to really flex up. You know, if we can get the work done on our own time, let us. You know, if we can't come in at 9 a.m., but if we can work from 10 to 6 or something, let us. I mean, my one 9-to-5 job, I have to admit, I got fired from because I couldn't come in at 9 a.m. I just couldn't function. So I was coming in later and staying later, and there was not any kind of allowance for this. I would hope that the workplace has gotten more, you know, flexible since then. You know, insomnia could, I mean, a disability issue, perhaps. I mean, disabilities are defined as something that threaten life functions, vital life functions. Sleep loss threatens a vital life function, if you think that sleep is a vital life function, which most of us would say it is. And yet, sleep disorders are not defined as disabilities, so we get no legal kind of backing in this. So we have to kind of depend on the goodwill of others, which is dicey, of course, you know, because others have their own problems too, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Now, what's interesting I was just kind of thinking a couple of different things about, one, children and how they deal with sleep.
You mean problems?
You know, in other words, like babies, when they're just in a setting and they're allowed to follow their natural urges, they sleep a little while, and they rejuvenate, and then they're wide awake,
driving
their parents crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Because their parents are around 8 hours at night and wake the rest of the time, and babies aren't. You know, that's really true. We are born with these sleep patterns that we later learn to relinquish. And babies sleep in pieces. Animals do. We sleep more that way when we're old. You know, the sleep cycle gets more kind of broken up and distributed throughout the day, not just one single block at night and then being awake the rest. You have naps and you go in and out of sleep. If you look at the way people sleep in other cultures, they're often, you know, the sort of pre-industrial cultures or cultures that are not quite as industrialized as ours, they often have this napping pattern, going in and out of sleep, just sleeping, you know, less during the night and more during the day. And, of course, entire siesta cultures have been organized around that principle. So it seems like we've been forced into this kind of arbitrary, you know, get your solid 8 and then be awake the rest of the time around industrialization, electricity, all that stuff has really probably compressed our sleep into the shape it has now. And it's no wonder that so many of us are aberrant, you know, that we still have cycles that are, you know, like more like babies or more like old people or something. And it's may not even, you know, it's not as unnatural as it seems.
There's an interesting story. I don't know if you'd heard this about Buckminster Fuller. He was kind of recognized in his later years. I guess in his 60s, he became known for, you know, being quite brilliant in different ways. And one of the things that I had heard from someone that apparently had spent some time with him was that for a while he was looking at how to be productive, and he would sleep an hour and then work 4 or 5 and then sleep another hour and work 4 or 5. What the way the story went is that he had so much energy and that there was just so much creativity in assigning tasks to people that he ended up backing off because it was like hard for people to keep up with him.
God, that's funny. I wish I had that problem. You know, and that might work for people. You know, one of my big messages in this book is find your own way with sleep. You know, don't let anybody tell you these are the 10 rules to sleeping better. You have to experiment. You have to just feel your own way. And you know, that pattern you describe of Buckminster Fuller's might be the way for you. I don't think would be the way for me. I have too much trouble going in and out with transitions. Everybody's different. I mean, everybody has a different, you know, a different time when you're most awake and least awake. There are some people who do have naturally this 8-hour unbroken block, you know, even in siesta cultures, even in Spain and Italy, they would kind of be awake through the siesta and more naturally gravitate toward, you know, a more consolidated sleep pattern. So you really do have to find your own way.
Yeah. I heard another interesting story. Thomas Edison, another creative person. The story goes that when he was on some of his, I don't think he called them creative binges, but he would just go and go and go. And one of the things that allowed him to continue, apparently he would sit in a chair and hold a metal spoon in his hand and resting on the arm of a chair, and then he would go into kind of like a meditative state and just relax. And then below his hand where the spoon was, there was a bucket. And so when he would start to drift off to sleep, and he would release the spoon, it would hit the bucket and wake him up. But he was getting this period of going into like an alpha state.
Interesting.
And getting some rejuvenation.
Yeah, very interesting. I used to use transcendental meditation that way. I've never been. I just found that so useful. I've never been a good napper because I have this trouble with really transitions. But I the transcendental meditation where you have a mantra that kind of shuts the babble up in your mind. You know, there's all these voices going through my mind anyway. lots of
you and many hundreds of millions of others.
I think so. Some people don't admit to it, but I think we all actually have it. You know, and the voice that just goes on and on. And this TM, the mantra, would just kind of shut it off, and it would get really still in there. And then I would go into this state where I was still conscious, but I was quiet, and it was just beautiful, and it was very restorative. I've got to start meditating again if I can find the time. But then, and I want to go on and talk about Winston Churchill, because he's another famous napper. He would. But he took real naps, you know. I mean, he would say, you got to get out of your street clothes, get into pajamas, go to bed. I mean, really do it right. And apparently, I'm not sure how long he napped, but it was, you know, an hour or so. I mean, these were not short naps. And, you know, what a wuss they'd say today, but really, you know, he was doing great things with his life. And now,
wasn't tough. That napper, you know, could only get a country through the worst time in its history.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and he probably didn't sleep very much at night either. But you know, and they're finding out. The researchers are finding out that napping is very restorative. I mean, that it can really have a wonderful effect on you if you can do it, find time to do it, and find an employer who will let you do it. They have to, you know, be flexible about this.
Well, I heard that there is some growth, and I don't know, I haven't really researched it, but some very small number of companies that have actually set up rooms with recliners and headphones and where people can go in and put on some soothing music and just kind of be in a quiet space and in a nice recliner and drift off for, I don't know if it's 15, 20, 30 minutes, I'm not sure, I haven't gotten the detail, but I'd heard that some of the companies were starting to catch on that they were actually getting more productivity out of people by letting them do this, they call them power naps.
Yeah, power naps, right. Yeah, you can only, you know, sleep is only justified if it is associated with power in this culture. But I think like in some of the high-tech industries where they really are dependent on the brain power of their employers, they're kind of catching on to this faster, that you just can't have a sleep-starved, dopey person on the job and get anything out of them. I seem to have read some company or companies in Silicon Valley, which would figure, you know, the IT and the high-tech stuff are being more flexible about this, letting their employers nap on the job, as we used to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that term has a bad connotation, doesn't it? You know, nap on the job, caught napping, all those kind of derogative terms, like if you need sleep, you know, what a wuss you are, you know, what's wrong with you? But they're, it's a hopeful move that employers are catching on, some are catching on to this.
Okay. And then it's got kind of nice to hear that for you, you found that some relief with some of what might be called mind chatter or just this, you know, this little processing, because I notice that sometimes it's people are told when they're not productive or not getting good sleep, you worry too much, you're stressed out, you're anxious, you're depressed, relax and have an antidepressant. Now something's wrong with that, right?
Well, there is to me. Yeah, I think it's a gross oversimplification of what causes insomnia. It's a one size fits all. you know, you're nuts. It's something you're doing to bring it on. You must have too much worry or too much stress. It must be something on your mind. Maybe you have a guilty conscience. That's one I found too. You find that in Macbeth, right? That's why he can't sleep, because he's got all that blood on his hands.
Yeah.
That really deeply ingrained thing. You must be doing something wrong. You know, it's not usually as dramatic as Macbeth, but there's a tendency to kind of kick the pass a buck, you know, back to the sufferer. Therefore, you can do something to put it right. That's because we don't really understand anything about it, and that's the way we treat things we don't understand. But
So there's a book I titled "Confessing Your Way to a Better Night's Sleep." That bad joke there.
I love it. Yeah, I could probably get it published. You know? Yeah, the best pillow is a clear conscience. I actually found that in an article on study of insomnia, the best pillow is a clear conscience.
You hear that kind of stuff.
We do. You know, the sleep of the just. You know, you would be sleeping the sleep of the just. There's no rest for the wicked. You know, it's all phrases, and in our, you know, medical lore and literary lore, it's all over the place, those attitudes. But what they are finding in what I learned at these conferences is that sleep is a physiological behavior. You know, all animals do it. And it is also very genetic. I mean, to a large extent, inborn and genetic, how much sleep you need, whether you need 5 or 10 hours. You know, babies come with sleep patterns. I mean, some of them are, you know, wide awake, and I was. I mean, as a baby, I was apparently a real terror. And some sleep through the night, you know, from the start. You know, and some are morning people, and some are evening people. That's all genetic and inborn. And so the more they learn about sleep, the more, you know, they are understanding the physiological mechanisms that make it happen. And yet when it comes to insomnia, they say, oh, but that's psychological. So you've got this weird thing that sleep is physiological and biological, and yet when you get to insomnia, oh, well, that's psychological. That's in your head.
it doesn't
add up.
You've just kind of opened a door in my thoughts here that made me kind of curious, because you've shared what probably, you know, millions and millions of people know. We have different personalities, and then you're talking about morning people versus night people, or that kind of a thing, and then parents talking about different, having several children and noticing different patterns in them. What makes me curious would be, I don't know if there's anything out there that would help support being able to determine or validate this, so that a person, if they were an amputee, you wouldn't say, well, this person doesn't deserve a wheelchair.
Right.
You give support where it's needed.
Yeah.
And if there was something out there establishing more that when you meet someone, not everyone types the same speed or reads or has different skills. Okay, well, here's another factor. What is this person's sleep patterning? Because I don't know if that's been out there, but the way you were describing it, mind is working and going, hey, taken into consideration, do you think that could be helpful?
Yeah, I think, you know, the more they know, the more they come to understand genetics, the more, right now they're beginning to isolate the genes, the mutations that are associated with delayed sleep syndrome, which means you get up really late. I mean, there are some people who can sleep quite well between 5 a.m. and noon. You know, they can sleep their solid 7 hours, and that's because they have this delayed. So those people, they get in the 9-to-5 world, and they get really badly mangled. You know, they can't function. They become insomniacs, and they're not insomniacs. They're people who have this genetic, you know, polymorphism. And the more that is learned, I mean, someday, you know, when they read out our entire gene pattern, they probably will be able to do that kind of thing. You know,
sure.
Do not expect this person to be functional before noon. You know, that.
Yeah. Well, I would wonder. because, I mean, people working, the employers, they want someone to be productive. And I was just having this Walt Disney kind of moment where someone is filling out an application, and on the application, it has information about, questions about their sleep patterns. As part of qualifying them for a job. Now, I know that's a bit idyllic, probably, but...
Well, it's also something people should, young people should consider when they're choosing a way of work. If you are a delayed phase syndrome person, don't try to be a surgeon where you have to be, you know, really functional early in the morning. There is some self-selection anyway. I mean, I think people who have sleep problems do tend to gravitate toward, you know, freelance work or the entertainment world, or, you know, you could become a sleep researcher and sit up all night and watch people. You know, these guys complain about it. I don't think that's really hard to see. But we really, you know, and it's like if people became attuned to their bodies more, you know, when they're younger, and kind of then try to work out a life that's sleep friendly to their bodies, and that isn't where they're not constantly at war with their own kind of sleep tendencies, then they'll make their lives much easier, you know, on themselves. But, you know, what you said also is, you know, the babies, you know, when parents have more than one child, they know that they sleep very, very differently. We are so different in our needs and in our patterns that's why we have to look around and find what works for us. There's no one-size-fits-all solution. That's why we have to find our way with sleep.
Ah, okay. And then, as you'd pointed out, coming into an industrialized culture, where they have certain needs, we want someone here, and we want them here for 8 hours, and we want them working all that time. And how long did it take for there to be actually enough organized labor? Where, okay, well, you can have a lunch, you can have some breaks, different things.
It's so inflexible. I mean, I have a friend who's a freelancer. He's actually a community organizer. And he has this kind of sleep pattern. I guess it's kind of like Buckminster Fuller, the one you just described, where he just plops down when he's tired, sleeps a bit, gets up, works some more, plops down again. He's enormously productive. He's self-employed, so he can get away with it. And he's had a good and productive life. But, you know, if you took that guy and tried to put him in a 9-to-5 situation, I don't think he would have survived very long.
Yeah, and you were making mention that there are some things happening in companies where they're starting to realize, and I think it's under the guise of, or the name of, a family-friendly work environment. Type of a thing. So I'm just kind of thinking of how do we open more of these doors, and that's one. Trying to put forward something about sleep patterns may not be as easy as. Mm-hmm. As dealing with with family and different family needs, and then they're giving people some flexibility. Okay, now there's flex hours. Okay, you can come in and you can then also do some, what do you call it, telecommuting or that is it, where you work from home part of the time.
Yeah, these things at least are being discussed. I mean, they're out there in the arena, so that's progress. I think, you know, part of what needs to happen is for insomniacs to come out of the closet on this issue. We've been so browbeaten into the closet, you know, we're not supposed to talk about this, we're supposed to deal with it on our own, that so many insomniacs are just more likely to kind of up their drug dose than actually go out and look for help. I think I'm still haunted by Heath Ledger's death. I mean, I think that's what happened to him. I mean, he, you know, obviously upped his drug dose and did some really, really dumb, you know, combinations.
Oh, I didn't follow enough of the details. I know he, you know, a great actor had passed on, but it was relating to some medications.
It was a mix of medications in his system, and they're all taken for sleep. And the guy, he had talked with some of his friends, and Michelle Williams, his ex, when was talking about his insomnia. He had really been plagued by it, and when you look at that combination of drugs, they're all for sleep. I mean, he was just trying to get some sleep. And, you know, you look back at some of the other stars, you know, Marilyn Monroe, Judy Garland. I mean, these famous overdoses, it's the same thing, you know. They were not able to talk about it. They weren't, there's no hotline, you know, there's no, you know, like there's a suicide hotline people can call, but there isn't anything for insomnia. We really haven't organized. But, you know, I think insomniacs need to talk about this issue, you know, to their families, to their friends, employers, and say, look, it's a serious condition. I'm not making it up. It's not going to go away if I take a hot bath. It's not something I'm bringing on myself. You know, stop sort of blaming the victim for this. And can we talk about it? Can we, you know, find out, like, how I can do the job on my own time, how there will be some understanding and allowance of this? But it has to, I think, start with us. I mean, I think we have to be a lot noisier about it than we have been.
Sure.
Cowed into silence, you know.
Yeah, and, of course, I mean, the obvious irony is, if you're talking about getting a movement started, there's probably going to be a little harder doing that with sleep-deprived people.
You said it. I mean, yeah. Sometimes, you know, we can barely get through the day. But look, I mean, narcolepsy, they've done it, and restless leg syndromes, and those people are very sleep-deprived. Narcoleptics have a terrible time staying awake. Their sleep is broken and their consciousness is broken. And yet they've organized into quite a nice group called the Narcolepsy Network. And it's done a whole lot to get the issue out there, you know, in front of, you know, to get
wow.
research, get funding. Of course, they've had a major breakthrough in narcolepsy. They found out that it is not, you know, because these people are crazy. It's because there's a deficiency of a certain kind of neurotransmitter. Insomnia hasn't had that kind of breakthrough, and we really
Plus, I could see an ad on late night TV that says, "Can't sleep? No problem. Join the Insomniac Association, and lobby for the help you need."
Right. You know, and when you look at who gets the funding, it's the people who've made the noise. I mean, breast cancer, AIDS, I mean, that's where the funding, you know, and they have made some progress, not as much as one would like, but some.
Yeah. Now, in your book, one of the things that I was not aware of, let's see, which chapter is it? Oh, yeah, chapter 7, Rock Hard Place, the Drugs.
Yeah.
Been in the 6 years very comprehensive at looking at a lot of different factors in your own search and in studying insomnia of what are people trying to do. And this chapter, it scared me a bit. I'm going, ow, spooky on some of these drugs.
Yeah, well, that's why I call it between a rock and a hard place. You know, you're kind of, you know, if you take, it's not good for you to take the drugs, but it's not good for you to, you know, have so much sleep loss to not take. So a lot of us just kind of feel like, you know, which is the least of these evils. But they're all problematic. Some are less problematic than others for some people. And you have to find that out for yourself. Nobody can tell you that. You know, when they know more about genetics, they will know more about which drug is best for us, but that's pretty far away right now.
Sure.
So
You have
trial
to.
Trial and error.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, as you said, you know, it's an individual thing. For some of our listeners, what I'd like, if you could summarize a little bit about some of the drugs that, and I hadn't even heard this term, I've been just for many years doing what I could to go into natural healing and nutrition and homeopathy, different things, and not to be involved in pharmaceuticals, but I'm kind of like this, you know, stranger in a strange land, you know, in our country. There's, I don't know, 300 million Prozac prescriptions written a year or something like that, or Zoloft. I mean, I don't know all of the names, but there was a term that came up with something about half-life.
Oh, boy, yeah. But just to say, to react to something you said before, how you feel like a stranger in a strange land, this really is a drug-happy time. I mean, these pills are given out like candy, some of them, especially the Prozac and stuff like that, and they don't know much about them, and there's a lot of incaution, you know, lack of caution, and so we have to be, you know, cautious on our own behalf when the doctor just really might not be. But yeah, the half-life concept is really important because it's how long the drug stays in your system, and that determines like the buildup of the drug. So that like with the older drugs, the barbiturates, the ones that Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland died of, it hangs around the system a really long time. They have a long half-life. That's the amount of time that it takes half of the drug to be expelled. And if you're taking them every night, the drug never leaves your body. You're just always, you get dopier and groggier. And then a lot of these stars, anyway, would get hooked on dexedrine to kind of wake them up, you know, uppers to wake them up and downers to put them down. And that, of course, you know, is what did several of them in. So the newer drugs have got shorter half-lives, and that's good. The benzodiazepines came in after the barbiturates, and they're better, certainly better drugs, fewer overdose, very difficult to overdose with that kind of drug. But each
now, is this Ativan, is that one
yes,
of those?
Yes, Ativan is one, Xanax, Valium, Restorol, those are the main ones that people take for sleep. Dalmain is an older one, longer lasting. Again, people have their Klonopin. People have their favorites of these, you know, ones that work better for them and not so well for them. Some of them are addictive with some people, not everybody. Again, it's so variable. And then came in the non-benzodiazepines, and they're like Ambien and Lunesta and Sonata. And I personally find Ambien my favorite because I usually don't need a drug to get to sleep. I can usually sleep on my own for 2, 3, or 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you drug your whole sleep, that's when problems begin. That's when I've had problems, when I've taken a drug for the entire night. So Ambien is a very short-acting drug. It's out of my system before morning, so I can wake up. When I wake up in the middle of the night, I can nibble off a little bit and get the rest of, you know, the night is drug sleep with Ambien. But it's not as, you know, it's better that way. And if I keep the dose low, if I don't do it every night, if I do it in the second part of the night and not the entire night, I find that the drug can work very well for me. When I've taken too much of it, it's pretty bad. And, you know, you do hear these Ambien horror stories, and I haven't done sleep eating or sleep driving or anything awful like that. But I did notice personality changes. It made me very unhappy, and I realized, no, this is not a drug you want to take too much of. So you have to learn how to manage a drug if you decide to go that route. You know, if you can possibly go the alternative route, do it. I mean, it's so much better to have your own undrugged sleep than to have drugged sleep. But I personally have made the choice that I will have drugged sleep over no sleep, and that's alternative.
Sounds like my Aunt Florence talking. She didn't like taking drugs, but she said if the situation warrants, and you can meet some of your needs doing that, then do it.
Exactly. I mean, I'm so glad I live in the age of Ambien and not in the age of those barbiturates, which were really problematic.
Now, do you recall any of the names of those?
Oh, gosh, Nebutol, Secanol.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of forgetting at the moment. There's also another early one called chloral hydrate. That wasn't a barbiturate. That's what was found in the bloodstream of, what's her name? Anna Nicole Smith. She had a lot of that and a whole bunch of other things. So that's still used. It's amazed it was still used. I didn't know people used it anymore.
And I guess from the book, was it correct that I saw that that you had some challenges with the Ativan?
Yeah, I at first I loved it. I mean, it was like being asleep at night and awake during the day. What a feeling, you know. It was great. And then I realized I couldn't stop it. without a serious rebound insomnia. And so I would stay on it the entire term, and then I'd get come off in the summer. I'd come off Christmas break. I managed to ruin every break because it's hard coming off. I mean, for me, that drug was addictive, and I also felt it was accumulating in my system in a way that made me really damped me down in a way that was bad. So I was very glad when I could switch to Ambien, which is shorter, and I don't have addiction problems with Ambien. I can stop it just immediately. But see, not everybody can. That's the thing. You can't. It's very hard to make general statements about.
Not one size fits all, and that's, I guess, part of the importance of getting your book, which leads me to wonder what's the best way to get a hold of a copy of this good book.
Well, it's. I mean, probably the fastest and quickest is Amazon. I hate to say that in view of, you know, how bookstores are going out of business. So, I mean, if you've got a local bookstore, order it through that. But it is readily available on Amazon. And also I have a website, sleepstarve.org, where I'm hoping to get insomniacs come to this website and leave their stories and get in contact with other insomniacs and maybe build some kind of networking eventually over time.
Ah, okay. Sleepstarve.org?
.org, yeah.
Okay, so that's sleepstarved.org?
Yeah.
Okay, and then there's a picture of you going to sleep at a conference. No, just kidding.
Actually, it was in a classroom, but let's not. <out.
laughs> No, you're contemplating. Come on.
Yeah, it was taken by a student, and it was. I thought it was just perfect for the book. It was totally fun.
Yeah. Great sense of humor. Oh, and then I see you have here something on Heath Ledger on that website. So that sounds like a good beginning point to rally.
I hope so. I mean, I'm really a technophobe, and I'm having a hard time kind of making this work right, but I'm hoping that I'll get better at it and that the website
will be. Well, I'm hoping through, what do they call it, internships or something? I don't know if you, or what is it when people are on work, I don't know if it's not work study,
but.
That's
a good idea. I hadn't even thought of that. I wonder if I could go through my school for that, you know?
Ooh!
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hey, I feel like I've done a good thing.
I like that idea.
let's get some resources so that you can, you know, have good ideas and then have others implement it. Because
Well, I need an insomniac techie, somebody who really gets it, you know, and somebody who wants to stay on the problem.
Do you have a school newspaper?
Well, you know, there's a really good IT department there, and there may there are people definitely.
Okay, mm-hmm. So we could have stirred up something very valuable here.
I like that, yeah.
Okay, yeah, get this blossoming, because this could be that rallying point. Your book certainly, I mean, has such importance in terms of the research about the different drugs and associations that are out there and things that people have tried. There was stuff, sleep clinics. You've got stuff in there about that. And I guess some of the challenge of going to a sleep clinic.
Yeah, yeah. They're better with apnea, those clinics, than they are with insomnia. It's kind of a disappointment. I mean, what I found and what a lot of insomniacs find at the clinics is, you know, we get a prescription for Ambien or we get a, you know, pamphlet on sleep hygiene. But if you've got apnea, they really do know how to sort of treat that and fix that. But if you have insomnia, I was disappointed in what the clinics had to offer. I know there's good clinics and I know some people have been helped, but it was generally a little disappointing. I found a lot more from what insomniacs had found to help themselves. And there's that whole chapter, Bedding Down with the Beast, which I collected the most ingenious and interesting kinds of things that people had found that helped them. And that was a fun chapter to write. I loved writing that chapter.
Ah. Okay, so this is just different things that people submitted that helped them handle it, huh?
Yeah, exactly, and how people had kind of troubleshooted it for themselves, you know, figured out what was wrong with them. I mean, sometimes it's simple, you know, like if you're a woman and if you're, well, not so simple, but if you're hormonal, if it's a hormonal imbalance, there are hormonal therapies for that, of course. If it's a racing mind, you know, some people just can't shut their minds off when they go to sleep. The most inventive thing I found for that was something called a mind machine, which is it's goggles and it's headphones, and the goggles kind of beam all these light, different light kind of.
Oh, is it the pulsating at different rates?
Yes, exactly. You know, and then through the earphones, you get this sort of weird outer space music.
Uh huh.
This friend of mine who had this racing mind, he said, "Well, you know, it really shuts it off. You can't even sustain a thought with this stuff going on." You know.
Oh.
So I tried it. All it did
okay.
was my heart beat faster. You know, so it wasn't for me, but it. Some
oh.
people found, you know.
Did it? Did it work for them?
Yeah. It just kind of broke the sort of obsessive chain of thinking that, you know, you can get into me. It made my heart beat faster, but.
Oh, well, one of the things that I think is important is to acknowledge if people have a lot going on in their mind and they're doing a lot of processing, that they're absolutely doing the best they can to take care of their life. I mean, because we could make some negative comments, or you worry too much, or, you know, what's wrong with you, or shut down the mind chatter. Well, one of the things that's important in my research is about an issue that I call ecology, which relates to if a change is going to be made, it's not just about like a person getting to sleep, but it's about making sure that the reasons that they weren't getting to sleep, the attempts that the person was making to meet some of their needs, that those get addressed. So that if a person is processing things and they put on a headset that will, through pulsating lights and sounds, slow their brain waves down from a beta down into an alpha or theta, that could be positive. But if on the inside they're going, "No way, I've got to figure some stuff out," then it's kind of like something that could be helpful, but there's a downside consequence to it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I see what you mean, but so much of that stuff when I call it worrying, you know, your mind is just worrying. It's not really, I mean, the impulse might have been that you have stuff you need to figure out, but in fact, when you're trying to get to sleep and your mind is doing that, you're not figuring it out. All you're doing is making it really much harder to deal with the next day, you know, because you're cutting into your energy for the next day. So I would say in that sense, well, it's sort of like pain, you know, like the initial ouch, that's productive, you know, because you move your hand off the flame. But then if you've got chronic pain and it just keeps going on, you really do want to, intervene with those pathway has been set up there and try to cut that off. And it's sort of like what with sleep. I think the worrying is not productive in anything. I found a visualization technique that kind of worked for me. People, you know, they have number games, they have word games. I mean, everybody's got a different kind of way of trying to sort of shut the battle off. And I like visuals myself. I mean, I actually find it, I love watching a DVD before I go to sleep. The experts say, "Oh, no, you're not supposed to do that." Well, it helps me, and it helped a lot of people I talk to. Because
good.
I work with words all day long. I write, I talk, I teach. You know?
Okay.
And so
get some visual stimulation.
Yeah, get some visuals in my, you know, it's, I've been watching.
And do you tend to like, you know, something pretty, scenes in nature, or
no.
Or does anything
like dramatic? I was just watching.
You Shakespeare
HBO
people.
Series. Yeah, I mean, I don't like violence, obviously, or, you know, but I really do. I mean, you know, my partner sometimes goes by my room and he says, "How can you watch that stuff before you go to bed?" And I said, "Well, it kind of distracts me." It
exactly.
Yeah, the illusion.
Gail, this is amazing. we've completed our time, and I feel like we're just getting started.
I
want to thank you for being a guest and invite people to go to sleepstarved.org to learn more about the work you're doing. And I just think it's, you know, amazing resource. And your book, Insomniac, and is that available on sleepstarved.org that they could order?
I think there's a link to Amazon. I think that's
okay. So there is
a
way that they can get there. Well, this is great, and I want to stay in touch with you because we've opened a door to blossoming this a little bit more, and I can see how important it is. And I just want to thank you for what you're doing, and I just feel like it's a blessing to our listeners, and I want to invite, of course, my listeners tuning in again next week. Week by week, there's more adventures and surprises of things that'll help us. So if you're not sleeping well, then go to sleepstarve.org, and we'll have some fun, and you can get acquainted with Gail Green and her wonderful work. So, thank you again. Have a great week, and beloved listeners, until we meet again next Saturday, God bless and take care, and goodbye for now.
Okay, bye.